Welcome to Modern Practice. I'm your host, Dr. Tom Willenweva, and today we'll feature part two of our talk with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford. He's going to discuss where we are with COVID treatments and where he thinks we'll turn a corner in our fight against this pandemic. Jay, welcome back. So in the last episode, we touched on vaccines and masks and their impact on potentially turning over the corner, if you will, when it comes to the pandemic. Now, treatments seem to be taking a backstage in the public eye. What do you think are the roles of therapy, and are they turning the corner, if you will?
Tom, it's real good to be back. You know, therapy is in some ways, we've made some advances, and we should highlight them, and they're good. So for instance, I think that the use of dexamethasone in the management of COVID patients has been quite good. I think it's saved many lives. The same thing with the monoclonal antibodies treatments early. I think those also have the potential to save many lives. I don't know, my sense, especially for monoclonal antibodies, we've underused them.
I agree.
The trials look quite good, and I don't know why we've underused them. In a sense, lots of physicians almost seem unaware of them. Certainly patients seem unaware of them, and I think we could have done better. There are other things, like sort of negative things that we've unlearned. Like I think the early ventilator protocols were way too aggressive and probably ended up harming patients. So I think that we've learned better about that. That's all to the good. I have to say, I'm fairly disappointed, actually, about the effort in the research community put into learning about therapies. In a sense, like it's been almost marginal. Former President Trump made the comment about hydroxychloroquine, which then turned it into poison, more or less. So no one even wanted to evaluate it. And it sort of carried over to the evaluation of other low-cost treatments. You know, other countries are using treatments like ivermectin. I've seen suggestions about fluvoxamine, a few other treatments. My response to all of these is, I wish I knew the answer. Why don't we have definitive trials on all of these? Like some of them seem promising anyways. And as a medical research establishment, we should have been putting more effort into that almost from the beginning, similar to the way we put all this effort into vaccines, which panned out really well. But there's no reason not to also try to understand better treatments.
I couldn't agree with you more in the efforts, particularly to try to find low-cost alternatives. Though I think that the monoclonal antibodies, I couldn't agree with you more. They're a great effort, but they're really costly. And there's the issue with access. Where can you infuse these patients? I think was probably the biggest issue. And I know as a practicing physician, my biggest issue is where can I get my patients infused?
Yeah, there's an HHS database, a Health and Human Services database of locations, but they're not, given the scale of the problem, there's not as many locations as you'd want.
No, there isn't.
Yeah, it's just really frustrating. I mean, especially since it's the treatment that former President Trump got. Actually, I think it probably saved his life. It's sad to me that we haven't really sort of rolled that out as much as we should have.
You know, Jay, you've disagreed with the public health policy, but regardless, how do we work with that framework and turn things around the corner, if you will?
To me right now, and we've talked about this before, Tom, at some point, I mean, I think that the main thing is the fear of COVID.
Yeah.
And I think masks are tied in with that. To some extent, for some people, it reduces their fear because it gives them a sense of control over being exposed to the disease. At the same time, for some people, it's a symbol of fear. And there's this politicization of it that is really, really unfortunate for public health. So I think this is going to be something we have to talk about. I heard Dr. Fauci say that he thinks that masks might be permanent part of our life when respiratory disease season comes around. I think there'll be a lot of controversy around that. I think the controversy will be caused by the fact that public health has turned this into this moralized, politicized issue, as opposed to just advice about when it works and when it doesn't work, when it's wise, when it doesn't not wise. And I'm not sure how to fix that. I do think that this is something we as public health professionals are going to need to address, because there may be a time when masks really are the right thing in certain situations, and people in the public need to have to believe us, that we need to have the credibility where they believe us. And in many ways, the messaging around masks has damaged that credibility. I think we're going to have to work very hard to fix that.
I agree in the sense that, man, it's become very political, and obviously there's the social economic components of the pandemic itself that kind of caused a lot of confusion in reference to the science, because many of these other components that had a voice, a very loud voice, actually kind of poo-pooed or even diminished the science, and that caused a lot of confusion. How about in the floors? Going into 2022, are we still going to be wearing masks in the hospital floors?
I think, yeah. In hospitals, they're probably here to stay.
Right.
I guess. Yeah, absolutely. But you know, that's not all to the bad. I mean, at least in hospitals, we're better knowing how to wear them and we change them frequently. And there's all kinds of like sort of benefits that come from it. I think in the population at large, I don't see that happening into 2022, Tom. I just don't see most of the population accepting it. Maybe in some places where mask wearing has become much, much more of a habit, maybe. I think given the politicization around it, I don't see it at a population-wide level in 2022.
We briefly spoke about in the first episode in reference to the aerosolized component to this virus. And we've also seen flu completely diminish during 2020 compared to that of 2019. Any comments on maybe where masking was actually effective when it comes to controlling flu?
I'm not convinced by that it's the mask that did. So for instance, in Sweden, mask compliance is like 2%. I mean, very, very low. And the flu disappeared there. And Japan has worn masks long before the pandemic. And the flu is common there. And there's a whole range of these like randomized trials about using masks to control the spread of the pandemic flu. I think flu is aerosolized, is my guess, just like COVID. I don't think masks are the trick. I think the more likely reason why the flu has disappeared is viral interference. In a sense, like the spread of COVID took up the resources, if you will, if you want to think about it that way, of the flu that normally would be able to infect a bunch of people who instead were infected with and unfortunately may have died of COVID. So I think there's some aspect of viral interference directly, both through selective pressures, but I don't know. One thing that scares me is in this coming flu season, we won't have any good idea what strain of the flu is likely to be common because the flu was gone. So what's that vaccine going to look like for the flu next season? I'm afraid that if we won't be able to figure out an effective flu vaccine in time, we may actually see quite a bad flu season.
I hadn't really thought about that, Jay. Thank you.
I'm sorry to think about you.
But thank you. I appreciate that. Do you see any other changes going on in healthcare going into the future? We've talked about virtual care. We've talked about expanding the scope, but anything else comes to mind in reference to healthcare of the future that were pretty much an innovation that came about through the pandemic?
This is not just an American problem. It's a global problem. I think a lot of places have a wake-up call, like the places that had spent a relatively low fraction of their GDP on healthcare have had very severe problems in staffing, in providing needed care. They have enormous rolls of patients that didn't get seen with cancer screening, for instance, in the UK and in Canada. Lots of sort of needed services that weren't provided. I think a lot of places around the world are going to need to think deeply about maybe spending a bit more on healthcare than they do. In the U.S., we spend a lot on healthcare already, like near somewhere 18 to 20% of our GDP is spent on healthcare. The pandemic, in some ways, it showed off our ability to use that effectively, but it's also showed off huge gaps in care for our poor people. Medicaid, for instance, I think has not performed so well. And I think it's a call for us to rethink how we provide services to the poor, to the vulnerable. Nursing homes, for instance, performed, especially in the early years, they were doing very poorly in protecting elderly people. It's a call for us to rethink how we measure quality and reward good services. In a way, the pandemic, I mean, so many regrettable things have happened, but I think the future could be bright if we work together to learn the lessons of it.
Organizations that actually had multiple revenue streams from value-based payment or even taking risk, if you will, fared better economically during the pandemic versus those organizations that were totally dependent on fee-for-service. Is this maybe a calling that we should kind of look differently at how we pay our providers going into the future?
I don't know if it's necessarily the case that we have to do straight value-based purchasing for everything. I mean, I think we've had some experience with that and some organizations have done quite well with that, but it's been hard to get most practitioners to accept those kind of contracting arrangements. I think the key thing is we absolutely have to change how we pay for physician services and hospital services. We shouldn't be thinking about services in this sort of reductionist way as you receive a single service, I pay you for it. When you provide a service, essentially you're providing a promise to a patient that this service is going to do good for you. And so thinking about ways so that we pay for the outcomes and not simply for the services themselves, even if the outcomes happen a few months later, where they're measured, thinking creatively around that, I think is going to be the key to healthcare reform. Give providers the incentive to provide services that provide good outcomes for patients and good outcomes will happen. I think value-based purchasing, I mean, I think that's the idea behind it. Sometimes it's hard to get the contracting around that so that you get lots and lots of physician groups to sign on.
I've noticed in the last 6 months when I've been speaking to different healthcare leaderships and particularly in the C-suite, they don't see it that way. They actually can't wait to go back into a fee-for-service model. Is that really realistic? Do you think that with the current environment that that's what we see going into the next decade, or is there going to be some change simply because we have no choice?
I think we have no choice. You know, 2015, we passed that law, MACRA, that actually implemented incentives to create these value-based purchasing organizations and also to change how Medicare pays or evaluates Part B payments for physicians to include these kinds of longer-term outcomes as part of the evaluation and tie that to payment. I think that was a harbinger of what's to come. I think going back to fee-for-service, a pure fee-for-service, trying to extend the fee-for-service to a larger fraction of the services we provide would be a mistake. And I don't think the pandemic has shaken the reform in that direction that very much, because healthcare is going to become more and more a larger and larger fraction of what we spend our money on. People are not going to want services that don't actually do any much good for them. I mean, that's always been the problem with health economics, especially in the United States. We pay for services that don't have any ostensible measurable benefit, or not at least large ones for patients. So I don't see that turning around. Because it's such a large fraction of our GDP on healthcare, there's going to be continuing demands for reform. I think no matter how much the C-suite may want it to go back the other way, it's not going to.
Are things going to change where it's not so much the bricks and mortars and you see it more becoming more of a virtual care? All things considered, that the population is only getting older and we need to expand that access, if you will?
Yeah, I think, like we talked about before, about telehealth, I think that will expand. I don't see how it doesn't, especially since we've been moderately successful within this pandemic. We saw, I think, Medicare put a telehealth payment provision in, and it just flourished as a consequence. As insurance systems start putting in incentives for that, it will flourish. It'll put a lot of pressure on providers to show that they can provide good services in that setting. And also, it'll increase competition among providers. Because now, if a service can be provided remotely, and you don't have to be present, well, now there's a much larger set of providers that are competing to provide that same service, potentially. I think that's all to the good. I mean, it'll be uncomfortable in many ways for many groups, but at the same time, for patients, I think it's a really good thing.
Anything else you'd like to mention, Jay?
We covered a lot of ground, Tom.
My sincerest thanks. I really enjoyed this time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
It's been a great discussion. Thanks for taking time for joining us. And to our listeners, please join us for other Modern Practice podcasts on the Vizient Medical Leadership Channel. Subscribe today, like us, or send us your comments. And also please listen and subscribe to SG2 Perspective, the podcast on the latest in healthcare strategy. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thanks for listening.